fitter, happier. A program about your health, for your health.
About 25% of our life is sleeping, so I guess you can say that it's pretty important. Not only do we have daily distractions that are keeping us awake, but throw personal devices like phones, iPads, and tablets into the mix, as well as sleep disorders like sleep apnea, it kind of leads us to not getting enough of the shut-eye. I spoke with Dr. Ivan Ling, respiratory and sleep physician at Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital, a little bit earlier to learn more.
We all know that sleep is an important part of everybody's life, but just how important is sleep to our overall health?
Well, I think more and more we're realising that sleep is probably what we might call the third pillar of health. You know, everybody talks about diet and exercise, right? But we can probably nowadays see sleep as the third pillar that you need to have a good overall health. So, you know, it's critical for your brain function, and it's critical to various aspects of cardiovascular health, so the evidence increasingly suggests.
Okay, that's amazing to hear, because I do love a good night's sleep. But can too much sleep ever be a thing?
Probably just in terms of your productivity. I'm not aware of any direct evidence that sleeping too much is actually in any way harmful to health. So I don't think I've got anything to back that statement up. It's just more like you probably don't need to sleep beyond 9-10 hours. I don't think there's many people who will need more than that as an adult.
Ivan, this is amazing news. For me. So let's talk about other impacts that lack of sleep may have on our body and our organs.
Okay. So I think in terms of direct effects on heart health and lack of sleep, the link is probably tenuous. Most of the research and information that we have is more towards brain function, you know, cognition, thinking, clarity, safety at work. That's more the thing. Mood, I guess, mood disorders can be a thing as well. Another thing I think I'll bring up is that there is also increasing evidence that lack of sleep, particularly in people doing shift work, you might imagine that they have reduced sleep compared to people not doing shift work. That can be a risk factor for cancer. And more recently, I believe the WHO, the World Health Organization, has actually put down shift work, chronic shift work, as a carcinogen, interestingly.
Wow, really? That's a bit scary, considering some of our major workforces out there are working in shift work.
Oh, absolutely. I can't remember the figure now, but I believe it's about 1.5 million Australians are working in some form of shift work.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's a bit scary.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about young people now. We know that young people struggle, you know, with their work, study, life balance. I know when I was studying, I felt like I was tired all the time. But how detrimental is sleep to people like this? And whilst they're having such a busy lifestyle?
I think it's going to be more and more so. Affecting all stratums of society. There's been some inquiry into sleep health, and you might be aware there's been a recent parliamentary inquiry, actually, nationwide. I think we realise that in our society, with all the increasing demands, the 24/7 lifestyle, availability of technology, more of us are being sleep deprived than ever. So I think young people in particular are susceptible because of also social pressures. When you're young, you've got all sorts of other demands in terms of, say, university studies. That's got different demands compared to stable work life. So I think people are chronically sleep deprived, and with all those consequences that may result in terms of loss of productivity. Of course, if you do have a sleep disorder, a sleep pathology on top of lack of sleep, that's increasingly detrimental to your health. So, for example, if you have sleep apnea, a very common, you know, breathing disorder in sleep, that has consequences on, you know, potentially increasing your risk for cardiac disorders, you know, for heart disorders, coronary disease, blood pressure.
Well, yeah, I did want to ask about disorders, in particular obstructive sleep apnea. Now, it's something, when I kind of think of sleep apnea, I always kind of thought it was an older generation kind of thing, but that's completely the wrong case, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, it is true to say that as we look at older groups of people, so as we look at aging populations, the risk of sleep apnea increases. So I think that that's quite clear, but that's not to say that a young person, even a child, can't have sleep apnea. No, it exists all across the age, you know, of populations, you know, all the way from newborns to elderly.
So what exactly is sleep apnea?
So it's sleep apnea, or I guess most of us refer to obstructive sleep apnea, is a very common condition whereby people may stop breathing, or they may breathe in a shallow fashion during sleep. And that leads to problems like lack of oxygen and disruption to normal sleep.
Okay, so it can be quite serious then if it's leading to a lack of oxygen.
Mm. So we believe, or a lot of evidence suggests, that most of the cardiac risk is actually caused by a strain partly due to lack of oxygen.
Okay, that's a bit freaky. How do you, like, is one person more susceptible to it than the other? Like, how do people get it? Are we just born with it?
So sleep apnea is mostly controlled by mechanical risk factors. So the things that would make one person more at risk would be increased body weight. So an obese person would be at higher risk than a non-obese person. You know, people with large necks, sometimes a narrow airway, including large tongues and big tonsils, and a family history, you know, that also can predispose. If, you know, your father or your mother has been diagnosed with sleep apnea, you yourself can be at higher risk of developing the condition.
Okay, so it's not something that we can catch. And another question I have about that is, are we generally born with it, and then it will affect us throughout our whole life, or is it something that could have, you know, come on suddenly?
Good question. I think some babies actually can have it. Now, that's not very common in babies, but we know that babies and young children can have it. But for the vast majority of us, patients probably develop it sometime during their life. A lot of people do develop it in middle age. But, you know, as I guess we alluded to, you can develop it any time in your life.
Sure. Okay. So I haven't got it yet, and fingers crossed I don't get it in the future.
Oh, maybe you don't know. Yeah,
yeah, this is true.
Couple of sleep tests. Yeah.
So another thing I wanted to talk about, I know that iPads and phones and tablets have all kind of made their way into our bedrooms in the last few years. I know I personally read a lot of my books off my phone. Do these have negative impacts on our sleep? A lot of people are like, oh, you shouldn't do that, Georgia. But I kind of feel like it puts me to sleep.
Okay. Yeah, look, that's a very interesting question. And I think there are a couple of facets to that. So, you know, why do technological devices, electronic devices, cause problems with sleep? Well, one is actually the light. So light itself can be stimulating to our brains and make it more difficult for us to sleep. A lot of devices, as you may know, have light filters these days. You know, they can cut out the amount of blue light on the screen that you look at, and that's been shown to be beneficial in being less of a disruption to your sleep. You know, so it goes like a bit yellow-red when you have a night mode on the device. The other thing is the actual interaction and stimulation. So I guess it depends on what kind of book or movie you might be watching. You know, some would be more you know, sedate than others, as you can imagine. You know, and if something's very stimulating, that can, of course, make it more difficult for you to get to sleep afterwards. And then I guess another thing I'll mention to consider is active versus passive technology. So if a person is sitting there playing a video game that can be very quick and maybe violent, that's different from reading a book, which is a passive thing, not an active thing, if that makes sense.
Sure, unless you're reading an amazing book that you're just going on a crazy adventure with.
Yeah, but even then, you see, it's still a passive thing. You're just reading rather than interacting with the device, which is thought to be more of a problem in terms of sleep.
Oh, okay, sure. Mm. Now, so give me some tips, or give all of us some tips on how we can get a better night's sleep.
There's plenty. So I think in general, it would be, let me just speak in more general terms. Okay, so trying to be as regular as possible. So go to bed at the same time each night as much as you can, and waking up at the same time in the morning, regardless of, you know, whether you have a commitment or work or anything like that. You know, keeping your very active commitments to earlier in the evening or in the afternoon. So, for example, if you're going to do, if you like strenuous exercise or very cardiac things, try not to do it in the, 2 hours before bed. That's general good advice. Caffeine is a huge part of many people's life, and a lot of the broader advice would suggest you don't take caffeine, avoid all caffeine about 4 hours before bed. And I guess some people would even say don't take any caffeine after about 3 p.m. in the afternoon. And then in the last couple of hours before bed, it's going to be low-key activities. Reading, passive things are okay. Some people find some warm drinks and a little bit of snack all right, but it would be suggested you don't eat a large meal within the last 2 hours before your planned bedtime. So those are the more general things in terms of sleep habits.
Wow. Okay. I'm doing a few things wrong then. Ivan, thank you so much for your time this morning on Fitter Happier.
Yeah, no, it's been a pleasure.